This is exactly right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you leaving? Are you on your way back home? Either way, we want to be there. Doesn't matter how much baggage you claim. Give us a time and date, terminal and gate. We want to send you off in style. We want to welcome you back home. Tell us all about it. Were you scared or was it fine?
With Karen and Chris.
Welcome to Do You Need a Ride? This is Chris Fairbanks.
And this is Karen Kilgariff.
Hello, my friend Karen. How have you been doing?
Hello, my friend Chris. I've been doing good.
Yeah?
I've been doing... Today has been a day of podcasting, no brag. So I have been sitting here in front of my Zoom for what feels like 11 hours.
Well, I had a similar day. I skateboarded in the morning and then took a long nap.
Almost exactly the same day.
Yeah, yeah.
Twinsies.
So, you know, busy, busy, busy. Gotta stay busy.
Come on, always stay busy.
Our guest today, I don't want to say his name right now because this is not his introduction.
Oh, we're going to do pre-talking about him.
But he's got a name. I want to ask a linguist where his name ranks as far as beauty. A lot of, you know, you always hear that elbow is the most beautiful word. Have you heard that?
Elbow? Cellar Door is the, haunted rabbit movie. They say it.
Yeah. Is it Cellar Door?
Cellar Door.
That one I get more. Elbow, it's like anyone can say elbow. It sounds like you're on Novocaine. You can like limp lip that one.
Elbow might be the ugliest and most horrible word.
I agree. I like strong consonants. I've always liked the word like corrugated is one of my favorite words.
That's great.
It's about that wavy piece of paper in cardboard.
Sure. There's also, I like the word pithy. It does a bunch of stuff and it makes you sound smart, but it's short.
Yeah, maybe a linguist isn't factoring in whether or not these words make you sound smart. Any dum-dum can say elbow, but our guest name today has, when we say it, do notice that it is a beautiful name. And I specifically like the way it comes off my tongue. I have not said the name.
No, not yet.
But when I do, take note.
That was not a false intro, as they might believe. We are still doing something. I would like to say this. Along with that very melodic and beautiful name, I enjoy this person's comedy so much. And I've missed it over the quarantine and over the years because I haven't seen him since I believe like some Washington, D.C. festival that now feels like it was in 2001, but I don't think it was that long ago. But he was truly one of my favorite people to end up at a show at and go, oh, yay, he's here too, because then I'm going to see something I really like.
Yes, yes. That's why I haven't seen him since the now closed Satellite.
Oh, R.I.P. Pour one out.
In peace, that building shall rest.
Please, please don't wander the earth, Satellite, as a ghost filled with sins, because you don't deserve it.
A lot of these businesses got shut down over quarantine and they're just wandering around in purgatory.
Ghost businesses all over Silver Lake, ruining people's days.
And the sad thing is they think they're still in business. They're just confused.
They're like, can I see your ID? You're like, you're not a business anymore. I don't have to show you shit. They try to stamp your inner right wrist. No, get away, satellite.
Where are all my employees? Oh, this is kind of sad to think about. Why do I get sad about inanimate objects having feelings?
Because the satellite was a place where lots of great comedy happened. So I bet you you're housing a bunch of dead memories in that dead business.
You want to know my favorite thing about the satellite, Karen? Was in the back room, there was a bar. And in that bar, there was bartenders. And they were under there. It was like a horseshoe-shaped bar. Above them were satellite dishes.
Yeah.
Which served as these odd, like acoustically, depending on where you would stand. Like my friend was like, do you want to see something cool? And they were at the other end of the bar standing under one of these satellite dishes and they whispered some things and I could totally hear it.
Yes.
So you'd never want to talk poorly about any of those bartenders because it was going right to their ear holes. All the employees went down with that business.
We've got to introduce him now. It's taken too long.
Of course we do. But do notice how beautiful this name is when we say it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've seen him at clubs and colleges all over the country.
So many colleges.
Truly one of the most innovative, interesting, and hilarious comedians to date. Please welcome the legendary Ian Abramson.
Woo! I am released from my silent prison. Wow. Thank you. What an amazing intro. That I really appreciate it.
Of course. So kind.
It's true.
So what is this thing? Just kidding.
Do you like your name? Do you feel like you it's a name riddled with soft consonants?
Wow.
It's got a nice rhythm, a nice cadence, a nice vernacular, a nice rhythm. It's got a jazz-like quality, your name. Mm.
I have never been told that. But if I'm being honest with you, from time to time, I have thought, I really like my name.
Yep.
It's a weird thing to say. Both of you, I'm sure, can relate. You both have wonderful names that are not, they're not like unheard of names. Karen, Chris, you know, Ian is not like a made-up name, but it feels very us. Somehow.
Yeah, I feel like my first name on its own, I need my last name, my surname to,
sure.
Yes.
And you are the kind of person, Chris Fairbanks, where I always say your first and last name together.
Of course, Karen Kilgariff. Why wouldn't you?
I was always grateful. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I was always grateful for my name because of the double first consonants, right? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of like, as in grammar school, is like weirdly a jackpot for, I don't know, initials, reasons and stuff. And then also nothing, no, they couldn't rhyme my first name with anything mean. So I was always no one could get me.
Baron?
Doesn't hurt.
Wow. Hey, that's great. especially when you're in third grade, you know?
Yes.
Calling a third grader Baron is not only not understood, but it doesn't hurt.
But, you know, I could have hurt your feelings. I would have called you Flaring Karen, like you had some sort of a disease, an infection.
Oh, like children's gout?
Yeah. Hey, Flaring Karen.
Gout.
Nice ankles, sugarfoot.
Children's gout. There's gout, and then there's children's gout.
There's children's gout, which is sadder. It's more condensed.
Oh,
smaller.
God. It's the feline AIDS of gout.
I actually have adult onset children's gout.
Oh, please raise your ankles up above your head, please.
I do every night.
I'm an adult child of an old person with gout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you, how were you made fun of as a kid, Chris Fairbanks?
I think it was always Chris Piss, you know, urine okay. Piss was always mentioned.
Yeah.
But then it became hacky, luckily, because of Garbage Pail Kids. And no one could think of a second one. It was Piss or nothing.
Last name, Fairbanks, seems like it would get a lot.
I don't take a stab at it. I don't recall any.
Fairbanks, not in America. How's that?
Oh, right. You know? I still get those. Mm. What about, yes. Yeah, people, isn't that amazing that people will think, oh, I bet he's never heard this.
Right.
The two words in his last name.
Yeah.
Being addressed.
Hey, have you ever considered
your own name? What about you, Ian?
Oh, I got a lot of Ian, Some kids would call me N, just the letter N.
There was that kid at my at Big Sky Bible Camp that was acting real tough. He said he accepted the Lord into his heart in the back of a police car. I find that hard to believe.
How old was he?
Oh, we were all 10, 11, 12. He seemed like he was like 16, though.
Okay.
Sure.
But his name was Ian, and I was just trying to make small talk, and I said, where are you from? And he said, North Dakota. And I said, are you a North Dakotian? Which I thought was a cute little joke, and he punched me in the stomach. I was relaxed, too. That's how Houdini died.
That is how Houdini died! Wow!
Yeah. This kid punched me in the stomach. He was not a fan of that joke, and I did not make a friend.
Wow.
Now, was that, going forward, your story of when you accepted Jesus Christ into your heart? Because that would have been a great moment to do
it. I was paranoid about it because at that Bible camp, they said, if you've already done this and you do it again, if you ask the Lord into your heart again, which I still didn't understand physically what I was doing.
Yeah.
Then it's a sin. So I was like, maybe I've already done it. Maybe I should play it safe and not throw the log in the fire. So I didn't do it. I never.
I don't understand the logic of that. God's going to be upset. I am already in there. What do you mean you're inviting me in?
Yeah. If the sin is, if you didn't mean it the first time, you already have a one-way ticket to Hades.
Whoa.
So these clearly are counselors and leaders at a Bible camp who themselves are red flag human beings.
Yes.
Where they're like fucking with children's minds about, yes, quote unquote, the Lord.
Yes.
It was a bad one.
It was a bad one. There was some strange adults there, and they made us think we were going to hell if we made any mistakes. There was a lot of talk about hell. Mm. More talk about hell than heaven.
Verdict.
Yeah. Kill us.
There's probably more people in hell than heaven, though, to be fair.
Right. True. First of all the people that jokingly say, oh, I'll end up in hell anyway, they're going.
Then there's the
people where it's a surprise.
But in the same way, there are people that want to live in the city, like LA and New York, which is like hell. And then there's people who want to live in the middle of nowhere and have some more freedom, and that's heaven.
Yeah. It's like a small town with a cornfield, except it's clouds.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd rather be in hell. There's more of a nightlife. Everybody interesting is in hell.
Yes, yeah, exactly. The density, and there's all those dance clubs and stuff. There's a lot to do and see in hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in heaven, they're going to bed at 8 p.m.
Right, whatever that is.
Yeah, it's probably comfortable, I will say that.
It's corn.
Or is it cloud? We don't know, you never know.
Ian, what have you been doing lately? What about that for an interview question?
Great, I love it.
Okay.
The summary of my quarantine is, because I assume that's kind of what you're really getting at. What has the last year and a half been? You can ask that to anybody, and there's not a boring question. In 10 years, we will all be tired of that question. But for now, nobody's made a sort of like nostalgic look back on quarantine. But once we start getting the Mad Men version of quarantine, we'll be like, okay, I get it. Right. But for now, I can tell you that I realized my brain was changing when I put on Silence of the Lambs at 1 a.m. as a comfort. I don't know what was going on. But that's when I realized this is not normal. That's when I realized, like, oh, something's shifted in my brain that I want to revisit this cinematic classic right now.
Yeah. Middle of the night.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't matter. Time kind of was just has become and still seems to be a malleable concept that you can manipulate yourself. It's no longer a rigid rule system.
Absolutely.
If you want to watch a classic at 1 a.m. or 3 a.m.
Yes.
A movie you've seen a million times, just to watch it in a different light.
Yep.
You can do that. It's kind of liberating.
I have a new favorite movie of all time that I had seen a couple times before quarantine and now have probably watched over 100 times. That movie is Ocean's 12. Not Ocean's 11, not 13 or 8. Ocean's 12 is my favorite movie of all time now.
Can you name a specific plot point that made the difference for you?
Oh, I absolutely can. Julia Roberts plays Tess, George Clooney's wife, as well as Julia Roberts. An incredible move. There's a scene in that when Julia Roberts is Julia Roberts is playing Tess, who is pretending to be Julia Roberts to sneak into a museum.
Oh my God, I rewatched that. I wondered which one I watched recently. That was the one. Yeah.
That's the identifier.
There's an amazing scene where Bruce Willis happens to also be at this museum. And so Julia Roberts is pretending to be starstruck because she's meeting Bruce Willis, who's like, wait, is this Julia Roberts? And like that, it's so fun.
And at that point, does no one know who anyone is? Like, at that point, is the audience and the cast equally confused?
I will say it is a convoluted movie. I will say it is confusing. But I think a great sequel is like a first movie needs to be really tight and perfect. And the second movie can be a little messier, but it just gives you more of what you want. Sure. And that's my theory on sequels. And Ocean's 12 does it great.
Wow.
Thank you, Steven Soderbergh.
So I've been watching a lot of Ocean's 12. I got into making things out of cardboard.
Yes.
Like miniature, like that neighborhood that is above your head?
In my office, which is a walk-in closet, which was another quarantine project. It was a storage closet. Then I was like, what if I made this an office? And any of my friends, I've Zoomed with friends. And then when they've since come over and seen it, they've been like, this is much smaller than I realized. And they're a little worried about me.
That you're hanging out in a tight.
I'm not worried at all. I'm not worried.
Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness. Yeah. But you haven't, I made Mount Rushmore puppets out of cardboard. It's just been a weird time, you know?
Yes, it has.
I got into miniatures too, Ian.
You did?
I bought these kits. Yeah. Like,
tell me everything.
Dollhouse kits. I love them, and I wonder if you love them, especially what you made. I always think of two things when I see these neighborhood miniatures. I think of the beginning of the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood, like that.
Yeah.
The little cars, it's the camera zooming down. But the opening, the long version of the HBO thing, where you in the end it flies up and a chrome HBO logo is like the Lord looking over this town.
Banana.
I'm sorry I'm being so religious today, by the way. But those miniatures and the detail as it flies over, there isn't even enough time to see little cars with headlights and there's little houses and lights turning off. I have been obsessed with miniatures since I was a kid, but there's this negative stigma for boys to play with dollhouses.
Not anymore.
I'm here to change that.
Yes, it's changing.
Love it.
2020, 2021 is the positive out of the negative, which is everybody gets to do what they want and do what it takes to comfort them. If that's Hannibal Lecter at 3 a.m.,
exactly.
So be it.
Exactly. Thank you.
Discover yourself in that way. Right?
Yeah, a lot of these Lecter types wouldn't act out with violence if they were just supported with their hobbies and crafts.
And not judge so much about their cannibalism. It's ridiculous. I was doing a lot of waking up in the middle of the night, and at first I would feel worried or like, oh no, it's 3 a.m. and I'm awake. And then I'd be like, fine, I'll just go watch more TV. And I had this kind of like, when you're home alone and you get to do whatever you want, but you're like 12, so you rarely... All the rest of your life is so governed and you're so constantly bossed, especially because I was the youngest. So I was like, if it wasn't my parents, it was my sister. And suddenly I had this like, I'm going to fucking eat M&Ms and watch TV at 3 a.m. Like, it was just like anything I wanted, I got to do. And there was a true joy in that feeling of like, yeah, of course I'm scared. Everything bad is happening outside my door. But in here, it's fucking TV M&Ms time.
Absolutely. I've never related to anything more. I haven't. I have tried to say that to others to explain my relationship with insomnia over the last year and a half. And you explained it so much better than I've been able to.
It's like a birthday party that only you're invited to.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. You can put on whatever you want and it feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah. put on some football pants and cowboy boots and a Viking hat and dance and eat candy. There's no one around because you're alone. You're tragically alone and having fun with it.
Exactly. Now, what I want you to picture is I want you to picture being in that exact mode, and you haven't been able to see any of your friends for a long time, and then suddenly you're in the room with 12 of them. Welcome to Ocean's 12. My best friends, my best friends, over and over again, hanging out, stealing art. Are you kidding me? Excellent.
Yeah. It's enough to just play checkers with Brad Pitt. But when you're heisting
together.
Yeah. It's a movie about a bunch of friends working together. Like that's all I was hungry for.
Even the enemies.
Yes.
It's hard. Even they're like, oh, I wonder when they're done rolling if Andy Garcia and George Clooney ever share stories about making love to many, many women or whatever, you know, something they have in common.
I want to hear them talk about miniatures. You know, they must have opinions.
Yeah.
Yes. What have you discovered? We know, Andy Garcia, that you can fuck anyone you want. But what about arts and crafts? Give us some glitter. You know, what do you do with glitter when you're by yourself at 3 a.m.? That's what I want to know. Yeah.
I usually put it on a woman's body. It's subtle and he's a beguiling man. I've been in the same room as him.
What?
And I'm not just talking about watching one of the Ocean's films.
I'm seething with jealousy right now.
Yeah, hold on. I've never heard an Andy Garcia story.
I interviewed him for a press junket for a movie called Smoking Aces.
Can you do me a favor and can you compare Smoking Aces to Ocean's 12 just so I kind of get... Just what
it is not as good. It is a group and you know, they probably had a fun time together when the cameras weren't rolling. But when the cameras started rolling, the magic stopped, in my opinion. This is not what I told Andy Garcia, but I did say my stepmom, who has since divorced my dad amicably, she... was so in love with you, Mr. Garcia.
You said of that to him?
She would just
said
bring
that the
you
divorce
up.
Was amicable to Andy Garcia the one time you got to meet him?
Yes, okay. It was a long setup, too. I spent like 10 minutes describing the relationship.
Uh-huh.
And I'd say that she'd talk about you all the time. We wouldn't even be talking about movies. And then
he was the reason that your dad got divorced.
He was laughing so hard just at the bizarreness of bringing that up. He was like so sweet. And he's like, oh, my God, I feel responsible. Could they get back together? Or he was so great. He played along with my weird idea. And it made me love him forever.
And then you said at the very end of that interview, you said, do you see that? What just happened between you and I? That's the energy you should have brought to Smoking Aces.
See how it was natural and it had a decent plot?
A rapport.
I know that's not your fault. So
there was a plot. There was a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Man.
So, Ian, you've recently been married and you won a contest. Will you explain?
I have. Yes. Wow. Talk about it. I feel like I'm on Comics Unleashed right now. That was an incredible setup.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I hear you like fish tanks.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Talk about an amazing setup. Oh, you know, I did get married. I did win a contest.
You're still married now, right?
Yeah. So, I mean...
Good.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm not like your dad.
You hear that, Jim?
That was an amicable joke. Okay, so I got engaged as quarantine seemed like it was starting to wrap up, which I guess was every single day of quarantine and still is. It always seems like it's wrapping up. But it was the time when you could start kind of safely going out with a mask, you know, is kind of how it felt. And my wife and I got engaged. And a month or two went by and we were planning a wedding for March. And then we get a very odd DM on Instagram saying, hey, your friend entered you into a contest. Do you want a free wedding?
Which I would think was spam.
And we did. Yeah. Of course you assume that's spam. That sounds very spammy.
Yeah.
But also, you know what they say in show business, you take the meeting. So my move was like, can we talk on the phone about this so that I at least could know if this was a real person? That was like the easiest way to cut through a lot of the BS to me. And we hopped on the phone and it seemed very real. The venue, Lodge Room, Highland Park venue, gorgeous, gorgeous venue, said they were kind of coming out of quarantine and they wanted to do like a big fun promotional event. And they often work with wedding vendors. So they would basically just like, it would be a kind of a big commercial for all of the vendors, the band, the people that make the cake, everything. They would handle it all. And anybody would be welcome. They sold tickets to our wedding. And
wait, what?
Yes, this is what happened. They sold tickets to our wedding. We had like an unlimited guest list. We could invite as many people as we could, but we had 1 week to do it.
Oh, shit.
Yes. So suddenly it was like a scramble. And I...
Wait, when were you... Had you already picked a wedding day?
Yeah. And we're still going to do it in March. March 5th.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Getting married.
Okay.
Have a second wedding. But we did get married at the Lodge Room over the summer.
Where does your family basically generally hail from? And where does your now wife's family hail from? How hard was this? How Ocean's 12 was this to organize?
Great.
It was exactly Ocean's 12 in that it was a complete mess and the best thing that's ever happened. I grew up in the Inland Empire out by San Bernardino, Riverside area, if that means anything.
Moreno Valley.
How do you know that?
I've been here a while, since 2017.
No, but did you know that I'm from Moreno Valley?
For 17 years.
He's from Moreno Valley.
That's where I really grew up. Nobody knows Moreno Valley. That's why I thought you said that just then. I thought you were like getting more specific.
It's funny because I know that it's because I went to skate parks when I first moved here. Yeah. And I would print out the MapQuest and a lot of the skate parks were all the way out there. So that's why I was in that area to go. Now there's plenty in town, but yes, that I am not gifted. I did not read your mind.
That's wild. It's kind of it's like an odd barren wasteland between San Diego and LA, kind of. If you've ever driven from LA to Vegas, you've driven through the area called the Inland Empire, which Moreno Valley is a smaller town in, and Riverside and San Bernardino are just like they're bigger and more well known.
Yeah, I've spent time in all those places, and I know there are distinct differences.
There's real good meth in Riverside.
Yes.
I had a crush on a drummer that was from Riverside.
Was his name Travis Barker?
Is he the drummer?
he's a drummer. Isn't that the Blink-182 drummer?
Is he the drummer?
Yes.
I don't know.
He's my favorite drummer with a checkered flag on his neck.
He's number three for me, but all respect to him.
Yeah. Tommy Lee, suck it, buddy. Go on a boat and be naked.
So, my mom now lives in rural Washington. So, like, right south of Canada, like an hour away from Canada. If you can guess, I will be amazed.
Is it not Vancouver, Canada, but Vancouver, Washington?
Ooh, no, but that's
no, Vancouver, Washington's
guess.
Down by the Oregon border. Sorry.
Damn it.
But a good guess in the same state, certainly.
Sure.
Definitely. Sure. For sure.
So it was too short notice. And this is, again, the world is opening up again. Flight prices were like insane suddenly. They went from dirt cheap to insane. And to try to get that in a week just was not feasible.
Right.
My wife's...
That's the main reason you have to do another wedding, right?
Yes. I mean, because we want to celebrate with our families and all that. And
people you know.
Right.
Yeah.
If a wedding is supposed to be one of the best days of your life, why limit yourself to one? Your dad knows what I'm talking about, you know?
Yeah. It's like, you know, I did Halloween 3 nights in a row. I think that's a perfect comparison.
Yeah,
great. Perfect.
Dead on.
So my wife's family mostly live in Buffalo, New York, and her mom was able to come, and her siblings mostly were LA based, so they were able to come. But I mean, most of the wedding party wasn't able to be there. You know, like they'll be there in March, but a week's notice is insane.
It's crazy. And so,
yeah,
were a lot of the people there? They otherwise would have been at a dance club. It was like a night out, or were they kind of in on the joke? Like they're like, we're going to a stranger's
both.
Wedding.
It was absolutely both. It was.
See, that sounds like fun.
It was. There were hundreds of people having their first major party out of quarantine, and we got married on stage. There was a 10-piece band that we never would have been able to afford. The cake was like a portrait, a cartoon portrait of us. They took this
what?
Yeah, and it was all like, it was vegan raw cake that was one of the best things I've ever tasted, no lie. It was it was unreal. And we were just like, our faces were these cartoon versions of us on the cake. And we showed up and it was just there. When you have a week, you don't have time to like nitpick. Oh, I want the cake like this. I want the decorations like that.
Did you have any input?
I mean, they were so communicative, but with a week, you have to just kind of like prioritize. As a groom, it's much easier too. You know, my wife was like, what do I do for a wedding dress? I thought I had months. And
right.
So she decided to lean into it and she made her own wedding dress. First article of clothing she's ever made. And she, she sewed it completely. And I felt like I was in the hit movie Ocean's 12 when I came in and she, I came in and like, it was like a biopic moment or something where she was just like, wait, I got it. I can turn the bra into shoulder pads. And
that's a good idea.
It was amazing. It looked incredible.
I love so this.
Yeah.
I love this. This is almost like it's the perfect thing to go along with the craziness that we all felt in quarantine in, you know, January 6th, all the realities that were like kind of denting all of our previous, like, this is the way things are supposed to be, which got that all got kind of swept away and in quarantine and in the pandemic. And then basically you guys came out on a wave of like, nothing's real. Like, raw wedding cake. And totally. We love it. It's so good.
Other than the band, like, what was the best part?
The officiant was incredible. I met the officiant that day. Shout out to Jason. He killed it.
Wow.
He had asked us for some personal stories that he, I do comedy. I know what good public speaking looks like. He was 10 out of 10. Excellent.
Wow.
Funny, heartfelt. It was, you lower your expectations a bit when you're having a wedding in the week. And he exceeded them by so far. It was amazing.
Do you think people there that didn't know him, didn't know you guys, do you think they cried?
Yeah, they did.
Yes.
People were coming up to
crying?
Us. Absolutely.
I love it.
It felt like a rock concert. There was literally a band. There were fog machines and lights. It's an amazing music venue that was fully orchestrated for us. They named drinks after us. My wife plays the harp. And so she had like the punk harpist or something like that. I had the Studs Terkel. And it was just like, this is amazing. It feels like a dream even saying this out loud to you, honestly.
It's so good. Cool. And when do you have your boring wedding?
That's so funny you say that. Because the people that say yes, we were not the first people that they asked, by the way. Part of the reason that we had a week is because so many other people were like, a wedding special, we don't want to be rushed into it, like, just because it's free. And we were like, hell yeah, take it all. This is amazing.
Yes.
And so we're planning March 5th wedding. It's going to be big and weird in Death Valley, and we're excited about it.
Nice.
Oh, that's cool. So you're doing it out in the desert. Mm-hmm. That's still cool.
Yes.
But it's the opposite of what you just did.
Do you think you could loop Jason back in at least to
Absolutely.
Officiate? Yeah.
Okay, Chris Gethard is going to be officiating our wedding.
Oh,
wonderful man, great comedian, and just that perfect He's that perfect mix of absurdity and sweet that we want for something like that.
Yeah.
And he's someone terrific. You actually know.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. As opposed to Jason, who happened to knock it out of the park, but could have totally beefed it.
Yes.
And did you know when they said you won a contest, did they tell you who submitted you or signed you up for it and you knew who that was? And because that would bring me some comfort.
Like, yeah. So our friend Suzanne, a month or two before that, had a Lodge Room just posted like, hey, we want to give away a wedding. Do you guys know anybody that's engaged? And all Suzanne wrote was something like she tagged Risa, my wife, and was like, hey, this sounds interesting, don't you think? And that was it.
Yeah.
Suzanne didn't think about it again. Risa didn't think about it again. The next time it was thought about was when we were on the phone with the Lodge Room.
I think there's really something to be said, though, as a person who has gone through a wedding mm-hmm. and the planning of it and the stress of it and all the things that get built up around it. I can tell, and you'll have this experience, so you'll be able to compare yourself. But to me, this almost like hands off the wheel, like, well, there's nothing we can do, is actually the solution to so much bullshit. Like, the reason there are like full-on Bridezilla TV shows, because when that series started, I was like, this is unfair, because it is not showing the background of why this woman has gone insane. I bet you her fiance is not fucking helping and doesn't actually give a shit. And she, all her friends from high school, like, this is a get back. And this is it's finally my day, whatever. There's a lot of like societal pressure. There's all kinds of ways this can go wrong. Hundreds of ways. And you guys just basically, you blocked it out.
Yeah. And you weren't screaming at each other about napkins.
Yeah, you were
totally.
Just laughing your asses off and like, I mean, it's so good.
Oh, that's, I want to have a con. Oh, that's so great. I love it.
Who was the person from Instagram or the Lodge Room or whoever that planned this? Like, do you know whose idea it was ultimately?
The owner. Yeah, this guy, Dalton, is like the kind of booker owner. I think he and his family run the venue. And the way the process went, because even on a phone call, this feels so crazy that you still have to, like, is this real? So the next day we go to the venue and meet him face to face. And he's like, no, really, we're going to do this. We'll take care of it all. And we're like, all right. And at that point, there's not enough time to question it. You just had, like, at that point, you're just going along with it.
Yeah. Well,
that's
everybody
so
go to the
awesome.
Lodge Room if you're in LA or around it. Support people with good ideas that bring people together in fun. Because if I had just been going to a bar with my friends that night and we happened into basically an impromptu wedding, I think I would have been crying the whole time, especially if it was right after quarantine ended.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, everyone loves a wedding that isn't theirs.
Yes.
And so all those people were so excited, and then you kind of had the element of being at a wedding that isn't yours, except
totally.
You're on the cake.
Totally. And
oh, I forgot this is my wedding. He just mentioned me.
Yes.
This is such a good show. This is better dinner theater than David and Lisa.
Wait, so you must have danced. Like, that band played and everyone danced?
I have these friends, Yoshi and Jesus, who came, and they're very into music, and they've never been a fan of the Killers. And the way they described the wedding was like, all of a sudden I was singing along to Mr. Brightside with everybody else, and I was losing my mind. It was unreal. It was because also these are like the best wedding band in LA, and entertainment people rush to LA. So it's like, these are incredible musicians on every level.
Yeah.
And again, it would have been so far out of our price range to get a fraction of that. They were just playing all the hits. I walked in on the rehearsal and they were like, okay, now let's do the 90s pop medley. And I was like, okay, this is what the night's going to be. This is, they can go decade by decade and just play the hits. They know it all.
Ugh, wow.
I love it.
That sounds so fun.
Like, my heart is racing.
I know. I have to. You could just describe a party to me now and I get all nostalgic and excited.
Just imagining it.
One of the hardest parts about a wedding is the guest list too, because you want as many people to come, but you have to pay for every single person. And so there comes a point where you're like, oh man, I don't know how to, it gets hard to figure out who to invite. And this was a free for all. Everybody come out. I could literally post on Twitter, if you want to come to my wedding, use this code. You know, like, that was all they had to do. So what that meant was people from all corners of my life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like from people that I knew as a toddler, in high school, in college, I worked in summer camps. I went to Chicago to start being a comedian, like truly every walk of life. It that must be what it's like to die. You look out and you're just like, there's fog machines, there's lights, and you're seeing a little bit of everybody. And it's like, well, have fun. Goodbye.
You mean hell, not heaven, right?
I don't know the difference.
Yeah.
This is non-secular or secular. Is it secular or non-secular?
I don't know the difference.
It's non-denominational.
The difference. This is I love this story. It's so good. Who was the weirdest person that showed up that, like, you got a couple of those?
It's impossible to, my wonderful ex-girlfriend from college showed up, and it was like, and she had messaged beforehand very sweetly and was like, hey, is this cool? And I was like, absolutely. It was wonderful. And I mean, that felt amazing. You know, my freshman year roommate was there. Like, it was just wild. And because,
can I just say,
yeah,
at
please,
my
sorry.
Wedding, I want there to be an ex-girlfriend section. I think that sounds absolutely
crying and wearing
terrific.
All black and veils.
Yeah, but, just kind of jealously mourning. Or let's be honest, most of them would just be, yay. But that's so great. I love that she went.
My wife is a weirdo harpist. I'm a weirdo comedian. People showed up dressed like there was some woman painted completely blue. I do not know who that person is.
So it was Rebecca Romaine.
Oh my God.
I might know who they are, but they were painted blue, so I do not know who they were.
That's what they were doing all quarantine long, where they're like, you know what? I don't have insomnia. What I like to do is body paint.
Exactly.
Was there like security and bouncers there in case things totally went backfired?
Yeah.
And there was like,
they're a well-oiled machine, you know? They're used to full-on
I want to win a wedding. I don't even need to be getting married. I want to win this contest. Lie and just show up stag.
Well, guys, I got stood up.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's
We're
dance.
Still doing the thing,
Let's
right?
Dance.
Let's dance and eat raw dance. Cake.
The immortal words of Kevin Bacon, let's dance. Oh, that's so
so
great.
Exciting.
Did Gary Busey go? Are you friends with him?
I got to meet him very briefly. I've met him.
Oh,
this,
really?
This is my Andy Garcia story. I told him about your dad's divorce. I got to do, he did like a kind of fake court show, and I got to be the post-interview person on the court
Isn't
show.
Isn't it called Gary Busey : pet court?
Yes.
Judge?
Yeah.
Judge.
This one you did know beforehand. This is not like Moreno
yes,
Valley,
yes.
right?
Okay. Yes, yes,
this,
yes.
This would be a little too weird.
But it's on Amazon.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fun. It's great.
You're like the Doug Llewellyn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
That's the name.
Had a great time. he was incredibly nice, but also those were very long days for him. So he understandably kind of was like, hello, great to meet everybody. If I don't pace myself, he's an older gentleman, you know?
He had to
take his own space and stuff. But he was very nice.
That's so cool.
Well, and also he's like an icon. So I think those people, other people don't understand how much they have to deal with as a person where it's like, no one's going to let Gary Busey pass them by without going, no way, and doing a thing. And after 10 of those, your Gary Buseys don't want to do it anymore, very, very understandably, and they have
for sure.
to. So, yeah.
Didn't he win an Oscar for the Buddy Holly movie he did? Or he was nominated. I know that.
Should I check?
Yeah, check, please.
I think that that's because we all know him now as being like this kind of crazy character, but he was a...
Nominated. Did not win. But yeah. He did win the New Generation Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association for the Buddy Holly story.
Yes, and the MTV Music Awards Best Kiss.
Best Kiss.
I don't know.
Of
I don't.
Buddy Holly in his glasses. Best Kiss.
There is that weird scene in that movie where he makes out with his glasses.
It was...
I'm just cleaning the lenses.
It was innovative. In. Innovative at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, you know what, Ian, I wanted to tell you is... The first time, and Chris, I think you and I did this show together, but the first time I did a Zoom comedy show, I could not stop thinking about your old show. Mm. Now, I can't remember what the name of it was.
7 Minutes in Purgatory.
7 Minutes in Purgatory. So Ian used to have this show where it was a comedy show. Like the time I did it, it was at the DC Improv. Mm-hmm. And so there's a full, like a sold out room of comedy audience that are there. You're in a side room, you cannot hear the audience, and you don't know what they're doing, and you have to do your set to a camera. And
that's every Zoom show, yeah.
It's literally, you are a visionary, and you thought of the thing 7 years before.
I invented Corona!
Why did you do this to us? But I mean, didn't you think of that, Chris, where it's like, you're just sitting there trying to make these jokes. There is no, eventually they got it so that you could hear laughter or people were trying to refine it. But in those early days, I was like, this is even Ian Abramson's bit. It's not fair that everyone else is stealing it from him.
And yeah, there's no payoff later where you get to see that audience edited with you in a closet.
Yes.
Like you just never know if you ate it or not.
No.
And you think about it for 3 days.
It's
in the same room with a bed that you just performed
in.
Yeah. That's on Comedy Central, right? Like someone could go to ComedyCentral.com and
it was
watch
a digital
those.
Series. Yeah. All the episodes are on YouTube and yeah, for sure. 7 Minutes in Purgatory.
Everyone will appreciate it more. It was very much ahead of its time.
Yes, it was.
Literally.
By total accident.
I didn't realize how, because when we went to do it, I mean, first of all, it was when I was doing a music act. So I was so grateful because I'm like, oh, great. I don't have to just stand in there by myself. Even doing it with another person and just like we're just singing songs, it was like the shame and self-loathing I felt literally 7 seconds in. I was just like, I can't. This is horrible. Horrible.
And you know what you're getting into. It wasn't like it wasn't snuck up on you.
It wasn't a surprise wedding at all.
Exactly.
At all.
I mean, it never got normal for me, and I did it every single time, you know?
You know what have made it even worse for you? If you dig your dog shock collar bit. Ian has this bit where he puts on, and I've put on one of those. It was from the 80s, but there was two electrodes on it, and you put it on your neck. And me and my friends just took turns barking, and it hurt so bad that my friend never let his parents use it on his dogs again. It was like inhumanely painful. But Ian puts one on and gives someone in the audience a remote,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then just does a bunch of one-liners. And it's like, if you don't like one of the jokes, give me a shot. And the time we did it at the Satellite, that person was a little trigger happy. And I remember there's no way, either he's the most amazing actor ever, or it's on a low setting, or he's getting shocked and not. I just imagine being in that 7 minutes in Purgatory on that show and also getting shocked. And you don't even know, you can't even see the audience.
You don't even get the payoff.
That would have made it even worse.
Yeah, it turns out handing the remote to a drunk audience member often wouldn't go great. But that was part of the fun, right? If you're being like, hey, electrocute
me. You were getting shocked and it did hurt, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The pain would last for a second. And like, you like think of like getting shocked a little bit where it's just like one brief moment of like, oh, my God. And then it fades pretty quick. But for like any time I would do it for like the next 2 hours, I was so on edge. My body was acting like I'd been electrified because I had been.
Well, I know with a lot of people, it's like a therapy. Even to this day, I have friends that have taken shock therapy. They still do it.
Like, really?
They're just better at it now, maybe.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you had long... I wonder if you're a better person for it, is what I'm saying.
Well, you definitely, I think, taught some people. It's like, imagine if you were on a date and your date was handed that remote and then you just watched as they shocked the fuck out of someone, where you're just like, anyway, it was great to meet you. Think that was such a good show. Yeah, let's talk to you later. And then just fucking book it to your car. Truly run away.
Oh, man. That's wild.
Did you do the joke and then they shock you, or would they sometimes do it while you were speaking? I never saw it.
So the idea, I would say, is like, you know, I'm trying to train myself to be a better comedian. I thought, how did I train my dog? So I'm going to wear his shock collar and I'll give you the remote. If you don't like a joke, shock me so that I learn not to do that joke. And it would almost always go like this. I would tell one joke and they wouldn't shock me. And the second joke would almost always get a shock, because by that point they had to know if they could really shock me.
Yeah.
And then during the setup of the third joke, they had to tell if I was faking it. And so they would like be like, wait, does this really work? And then at that point it became, are they a good person or a bad person?
Yes.
And it would go one of two ways.
Fuck.
And did you ever do that bit where someone just you couldn't even get through a joke because they were just shocking you the whole time?
Yeah. And I would be like shaking, like, you realize I'm literally being electrocuted, right? it wasn't on like the highest setting and it's designed for dogs, but it did legitimately hurt.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. That's the best.
So then while you're being hurt and trying to reason with this person, people are laughing harder and harder at the entire situation.
It's such a good bit.
It's a stunt.
It's like a physical stunt. I love your comedy anyway.
Me too.
Yeah, but bits like that where it's this... there's an intensity because you know something's going to happen and you set it up ahead of time. And then on top of that, you're just doing stand-up. And it's a great time to do all your throwaway one-liner bits that you like that maybe usually get like a...
Exactly.
I have so many
puns
and everything that I've always loved and they get a groan. I remember watching you do that and I'm like, wow, what a perfect place to showcase all of your, you know, your word children.
It reminds me of coming up in San Francisco, mostly there and it was the early 90s. Everyone was really trying to be quote unquote edgy. You know what I mean? Most of the time that meant like, hey man, fucking John Wayne Gacy or you, whatever. Like you tried to show us, but I did it all the time where it's like, you won't believe I said that. But you're really putting your money where your mouth is in that way. Where it's just like, I'm going to be so edgy. I could have a cardiac incident here. Let's do this thing.
Ever worry about that? That it would all of a sudden affect your heart rate or something? Like have a heart attack? Because, the setting, stop doing it. And then you just go into cardiac
arrest. And then the laughter just builds and builds.
Yeah, they're just laughing at your limp body.
I mean... It would affect me. Like, it really would affect me. I would feel a little more aggressive for like 2 hours. I would have to be like, I need to chill out right now. Because it's like your body is like, it was reacting like I was being attacked, because it kind of was.
You were.
Oh, God, I love it.
That's
such a great bit. I forgot about that.
Very kind.
So great.
And what do you miss about the old comedy days, the old doing sets around town? That's a very specific and odd question.
Yeah, have you been getting
question.
Back at it at all?
Yeah, definitely starting to. I've been the last quarantine obsession I'll talk about. This is how I've kind of filtered my creative energy. I got really obsessed with ex-president Theodore Roosevelt. And I wrote 90 minutes of Theodore Roosevelt material. And now I'm getting to test that out around town. The one person on everybody's mind. The second most famous Roosevelt.
Why did you write an hour and a half of Teddy Roosevelt material?
The same reason Ocean's 12 is my favorite movie and I watch Silence of the Lambs at 2 a.m. There's just not answers, even though it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
He larger than life figure. He's literally on the Mount Rushmore of presidents, which is why I made the cardboard Mount Rushmore puppets. That's like that's part of it.
That comes into it.
Ties in. So
yeah, minute 70 is when those puppets come out.
Yeah. I'm definitely paring it down. The first version of it was basically a 90-minute TED talk about a president that only I cared about. But then, you know, trying to turn it into bits and everything. That's the fun of going back out, is trying to turn something from a TED talk into comedy. Mm-hmm. And I miss that. I miss just getting to like throw things against the wall and trying to be like, oh yeah, this is working and not working. And how can I get the thing that's not working to work? And I'll always love that. And it was really hard to not have that during quarantine. What about you guys?
I mean, I enjoyed it. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast. That's like we both paused, but I enjoyed the no pressure. I didn't realize how it was always looming over me. Like, how am I doing in comedy? Am I doing everything I should or could be doing? How's everyone else doing? No matter how hard you try, you are kind of obsessed with where you stand among your peers. And it is kind of a contest a little bit.
Yeah.
And for that all to be lifted, I mean, my gray hair went away. It's coming back. but yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the time off. And I'm having trouble fully diving back in. Like, I've been doing shows, but I enjoyed not doing it. It was great. I felt like a 17-year-old. I just wasn't worried about things.
Totally.
I basically stopped doing sets. And then tried to start doing them again after way too long, you know, like I would say 3 years or something of not really doing it. Mm-hmm. The thing is, and this has happened to me before in the past, of when I stop entirely, I truly just do not believe I can do it anymore. Like the thing I do in my own brain is unbelievable, where it's like, this is something I've been doing since I was 20 years old. It's crazy. And it's like, you didn't forget how, but what it is the time I wasn't putting in the time and I wasn't focusing on other people. I think that competition element, although it can be bad, also it can be amazing, because I go to shows, and I think Chris and I have talked about this before, but one of my favorite things to do is go watch a bunch of other people do sets, because my brain is, I have such defiance disorder that while I watch people that I love and I'm laughing at, my brain starts writing material that is totally unrelated. And it's so, it's like my brain's going, you've got to fight for your place. And here's an idea. You know what I mean? Where it's like, oh shit. So there's a kind of cultural immersion that I think I have to have. You know what I mean? But as like a now middle-aged woman, I just don't want to have to do that. Like, I want to see my friends and see the people I really love. But ultimately, it's a young man and woman and person's game. So like, it's like, don't go. I just started getting that thing of like, you kind of have to, it's like, let it go. You can always like do a set if you want to, but ultimately, the part that I really love about comedy is that beginning. How do you take a TED talk and turn it into an actual bit? How do you actually make people laugh? Because for a while I was just reading old tweets and then just kind of standing there going, ew, this is a Pyrrhic victory if there ever was one. This feels bad. This is not well-written material. So, you know, it's kind of that, where I think it gave me in quarantine, just truly, I told myself my job was to not go insane. So I didn't have to worry about that or, you know, it was just like, get your work done and stay happy. And other than that, don't put yourself through it, because that whole push-pull of comedy, although it is my true and first love, it's like, yeah, but also you can't be doing, you know, showcase nights for the rest of your life. Like, you have to take your pension after a while. If you're not like a, you know, if you're not like, sure, a headlining comic or whatever. So yeah, it was a relief in that way, where it's like, I can still be a fan. I can still know all the people that I know. I can be proud of the people that I watch go and do things and be innovative. And truly, that's why, like, when I watch you do comedy, It's like, it reminds me of my early days when people were like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to fucking try this bit. And it was all very punk rock. And it's, you know, I just really love it and support it.
That is so kind. If it's not clear, I will just say here and now that I am huge fans of you both, deeply admire you. You've been inspirations from day one. So thank you, you both. You've said such kind things about me. And I felt bashful about saying that about you, but now I'm going to.
You have to. You have to.
Yeah. What is a podcast except a chance to do that?
Right?
Circle jerks get a bad rap. But that just felt great.
Right? It's what people need these days. Mm-hmm. Also, it's like that weird thing where like Chris and I see Chris consistently because we have this podcast, luckily, and thank God, because, you know, other comedians are some of my favorite human beings because of their brains and the way their brains work. And you don't meet those kinds of people every day. And I think that's another thing is like really appreciating. It's like, Ian Abramson, when that name came through, I was like, oh my God, yeah. Like, how else would I see you? You know what I mean?
It's right, like, right. Wow, that's so great. Kind.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really is kind of a special community. And I feel like quarantine was freeing for so many people rather than making us all cynical. Things got so bad for everybody, for literally every single person, that it was kind of like, well, if that's the baseline, I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to carry that over and remember it. I found myself like this past weekend, I did shows in Irvine, and I was like, don't go back to being upset if the audience doesn't remember what it was like to not have this.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. And I have been enjoying it, but I got to remember not to lose that. I've got to remember to stay appreciative.
Are you saying, Chris?
Because I promised myself.
And the audience like doesn't remember how to be an audience, kind of? Is that what you mean?
Oh, I sometimes, if an audience isn't acting the way I want to, I was getting impatient with crowds.
Yeah.
And I promised myself I wouldn't do that when I didn't have access to that. I'm like, okay, I miss it. I'm going to even appreciate the most drunk and heckly crowd that is anti-vaxxer or whatever. I don't care where I'm at. I've got to appreciate this. And so far I have felt like I'm appreciating it more than before this thing happened. But I got to hold on to that.
Do you think the sets are going better because you have that energy?
Oh, certainly not, because I still don't know what the hell I'm doing, and I'm just still rusty. I'm you know, because that thing that you mentioned, like you feel like you forgot how to do it. I'll do that during a weekend of shows. Like I did shows last night. It went fine. Why would tonight not go well? And I don't feel good until I get that first laugh. And then I'm like, okay, I guess this won't be terrible.
Yeah.
I always, it's a clean slate of like, this might be terrible for me. I'm always able to put myself there, and I shouldn't, but I do.
I did a show last week. And the first half of my set was like tried and true material that I was just like, let me just take out some of the old hits, you know? And
yeah, of course.
That felt so much weirder than the second half of my set, which was brand new Theodore Roosevelt stuff. Because it felt like driving a tractor where I was like, wait, I've driven a car and I kind of know what this is like, but there's some weird stuff here that I don't understand what's happening anymore. And then the second half, I was like, okay, now I'm just walking around. I get this.
What's your favorite fact about Theodore Roosevelt that you...
You've spun into comedy gold.
I will tell you. One of Theodore Roosevelt's... if you look at a top 10 list, there will be something about how much he loved animals and hunting. He founded the national parks. He was... But the way that this love started, he was a little boy, and he went to the store and got obsessed with a dead seal. They were selling a dead seal, and he went back for days to be like, hey, could I get the dead seal? For days. And eventually they gave him just the head.
No.
And he took, go to Wikipedia, control F the word seal, and it will be confirmed. The craziest, the reason I've had so much fun with this is like that particular fact is not on top 10 lists. How is that not the thing we're all talking about? This is one of the greatest presidents ever, and he carried a seal head home.
And did it talk about his relationship or what he did with this disembodied seal head or what was his goal to get into taxidermy?
You honestly just nailed it because he did get really into taxidermy and he became obsessed with taxidermy, but also the reason that the way he would use his taxidermy is he tried to open up a little museum with his cousins and the seal head was like the big display.
Yeah, that's behind a velvet rope.
Right. Yes. Yeah, he would like capture bugs and it'd be like, oh, I'm sure showing his parents like, oh, very cute, Teddy. You got some bugs. And is that a monster head? What is this? Is not a creature we see every day. We don't have the internet to know what a seal even really is. But here is the rotting head of an animal. Okay.
I am seeing an Adult Swim animated series when you get all these things together that's just like almost like a true crime documentary but about Teddy Roosevelt and all the things about him that are disturbing to say the least.
Totally. Another fun fact.
Wasn't he shot during a speech too and finished the speech or did some push-ups at the end?
I cannot believe you just said this. Again, I feel like I'm on Comics Unleashed right now. Because I was about to say, let me give you one more fun fact, and yes. It tied into that. My favorite part of this has been taking these big things. You know that Teddy Roosevelt, right as he was about to give a speech, was shot in the stomach. And he gave the speech, and the speech was like an hour and a half. He spoke for an hour and a half as he was bleeding, and the crowd knew that he was bleeding. But his whole thing was like, I'm a manly badass. So that added to it. But what nobody asks about is the man that shot him. So I did a bunch of original research. I went through like university archives and I ended up finding handwritten letters that have never been transcribed that the guy that shot Teddy Roosevelt wrote after being put in an asylum to the doctor being like, I'm not crazy. Yes, I saw a ghost that told me to kill Teddy Roosevelt, but I'm normal. Let me out. And it's like, it's a man's actual writing. And it's like...
And he said a ghost told him to do it?
More specifically, the way that this is why it feels a bit like a TED Talk, and I apologize. Teddy Roosevelt became president because he was vice president and William McKinley was assassinated. And this guy, John F. Schrank, said that William McKinley came to him in a dream and was like, if you don't kill Teddy Roosevelt, the world will end. And so he was like, well, I guess I got to go kill Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, it's like a civic duty at that point,
yeah. Right?
It's a global duty.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a universal
duty.
Obligation. Or duty.
So do you ever lay into your 90-minute presentation any kind of you're getting shot element? Do you try to parallel that in your own speech?
Like about my life?
Well, that you're doing a 90-minute speech.
Oh.
So at some point, don't you think you should also get shot? So that
it opens with the gunshot.
Oh, okay,
Please,
just want to get it out there.
I love this. We're getting so much work.
I'm gonna give this gun to someone in the audience. If you don't like a joke, shoot me square in the stomach.
the bit that I'm working on, and the bit that I did last week, I start telling the story of him getting shot, and then I'm like, wait, can somebody actually stand in, be Teddy Roosevelt, and I'll show you where we're standing. Actually, can I be Teddy Roosevelt? You be the guy shooting. And actually, there was somebody standing next to him. Could you? And just getting like 15, 20 people from the audience by the end to come up and act out this whole scene. And just like kind of playing with that. It's not really fully worked out yet. But that's how I'm trying to make it more performance and less TED Talk.
I love that you do that. Yeah,
I have a pitch.
There was a comic that I came up with in Austin, Rich Gabe, that would give a piece of paper. He'd give like, here's your line. He would hand it to people in the audience. He's like, when the lights flicker, and we have everyone had a piece of paper with directions. Like, when this happens, yell this out. And everyone was involved. And it was so fun for the whole audience. And it was one long 5-minute bit.
That.
And
yes.
And you've always reminded me of him. So I love that you also have
a
bit like that.
That's wonderful.
That's very Ron Lynch-y too. That very kind of like, we're all in this together.
He won the funniest person in Austin contest and moved. I don't think he did stand up after that, but it wasn't stand up. It was these performance bits. He had like
that's excellent.
A ventriloquism bit that was a tape recorder that he'd leave on stage while he went to get a drink of water and a pillow that had a voice in it. And it was a pillow. And I can't even remember the bits, but they were all planned out and well-timed. And yeah, to give an audience a role.
Yes.
Or a line, or to get them on stage with you. Everyone loves that. It's I love seeing that, and I've never had an idea like that. I'm jealous. What about your, is it called Inland Empire?
The short?
Yeah.
You did do your research. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much.
Oh, that I did. Yeah, that I looked up. Yeah, yeah. How do people watch that?
Yeah, on Vimeo, it was a staff pick, so we hope you like it like they did. My friend Tim Barnes and I wrote a short and starred in it, directed by Zane Rubin, who's my wife's sister. That's how I actually ended up meeting my wife, was Zane Rubin.
Introduced
me. I know, isn't that awesome?
That's great, terrific.
But Inland Empire. Very very proud of that short. It's kind of like a weird take on our weird upbringing. So check it out.
Awesome.
Nice. Vimeo, staff pick. Those people see a lot of video. So that's
and
really
watch his
saying
post-trial interviews on Gary Busey, colon,
absolutely.
Pet judge. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Ian Abramson.
Thank you both
for being
so much.
See, I say the name and I stumbled. Ian Abramson. It's hard for me to say.
You're overthinking
Abramson.
It. Yeah.
Ian Abramson.
Yeah, you got it.
I am always overthinking things.
You don't want to mess up such a beautiful thing.
A linguist will tell you. Mm-hmm. Ian Abramson is a beautiful man. And a beautiful man. Thank you for being
Thank
on.
Thank you, Ian.
You've been listening to Do You Need a Ride? DYNAR! This has been an Exactly Right production.
Produced by Annalise Nelson.
Engineered by Stephen Ray Morris.
Mixed by Roy Tanaka.
Theme song by Karen Kilgara.
Artwork by Chris Fairbanks.
Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at DYNAR Podcast. That's DYNAR Podcast.
For more information, go to exactlyrightmedia.com.
Listen, subscribe, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. Sometimes I can't remember if I honked last time.